Oh. Oh, I didn't even think of that because we could do it last week only because Bill wasn't having his class because they're not meeting in the auditorium. Yeah, he's in. You don't want to go upstairs, do you? You can go up on that, any of those rooms. That one there, the door is open. Okay, I'm sorry. We'll have to figure that. How many more weeks is Bill's class? Rachel, do you know how many more weeks is Bill's class? So, one more week, and then you can. Yeah, well, that's well. The auditorium worked out really well for them, but you know now it's just filled with stuff again. So. The latest word, official word from the MART is that they're hoping to do carpet the third, which is, well, that's 2 weeks earlier. They told us they couldn't get to it till the 19th of May. So, and, you know, on a serious note, the conversations that we've had and the communication that we've had about going back into the auditorium has been pretty much consistent that there are a number of people who don't think we should go back in there while the mask mandate is in effect. And I don't have any problem with that. And I'm really not trying to be snarky or snippy, but I guess the question becomes, what if they extend the mask mandate yet again? And, you know, run it through the summer. I mean, personally, I'm not prepared to stay in here forever and ever because the city council has a mask mandate, and so I don't know. So we'll but for now, you know, the mask mandate goes through the 25th. Is it right? Do I have that right? The 25th of May. So I think what we are thinking and hoping is that the auditorium remodeling will be done and completed before the Memorial Day weekend, and so that commencement exercises for the high school will be down there and the gym will be open and we'll be back in the auditorium the first week in June. That's tentatively what we're thinking, but as one of the Air Force guys said to me one time, flexibility is the secret of air power and indecision is the secret of flexibility. And so all decisions are not yet final, but that's kind of what we're thinking. That's kind of how I'm thinking. Isaiah chapter 1 is where we will begin this morning. Isaiah chapter number 1. Isaiah chapter number 1. And our focus is we're just going from the book of Genesis, and we're going to pretty much systematically work our way through the Bible, talking about the kingdom of God in the way that it is presented in the scriptures. It is a dominant theme in the scriptures, and most believers understand that. The disagreements arise over exactly what the kingdom is. In other words, will there be a literal kingdom or is it a figurative kingdom? And then another question is, when will this kingdom happen? And then in conjunction with that are questions about when the return of Christ fits into that scenario. We would, of course, believe that he is going to come and set up the kingdom, and others believe that we're going to set up the kingdom and then Christ will come and take it over. So all of those things then are, you know, always part and parcel of all the discussion. And the fact that there is so much discussion about them is the consequence of the fact that, you know, it would in some ways, and I want to be careful there because I'm not trying to suggest that God should have written the Bible differently. But realistically, if there was a paragraph or a sentence that gave to us the timetable and the exact sequence of events, there would be a lot less to fight about. but we don't have that. What we do have is regular systematic repetition about the existence of a kingdom and the nature of the kingdom. And part of what God has for us is to put all those pieces together as we work through them and come up with an understanding of the scriptures. Let's pray, and we'll turn our attention to Isaiah this morning. Father, in light of the fact that it's your kingdom and we are your subjects and we are finite and you are not, we pray that you would help us, that it would be we would have right knowledge of what the scriptures teach, that we would conform ourselves to your position, that we would understand it. And I pray this for us in Jesus' name. Amen. I would point this out, and I would hope that it would be true, that I could say it truthfully about myself. Jesus said in John chapter 7, if any man will, how's it go exactly? If any man will do his will, he will know of the doctrine. And so in all of these things, folks, you know, we don't want to just have an empty mind, but we do want to have minds that are open, that the scriptures teach things that we may not embrace at first outset, and that we submit ourselves to the teaching of the scriptures. So I don't want to just approach it, this is what I believe, and now I'm going to go looking for verses to defend it, but to look at all the verses and trying, hopefully, to make sense of why I believe what I believe. All right, so this morning we're in the book of Isaiah. We're actually going to take a couple of weeks talking about the kingdom in Isaiah. Isaiah details much about it. It would be my position, and the position from which I would teach, that the failure of Israel to live to its covenant obligations do not undo either God's creation purpose nor the covenant itself. And I mention that because there are many good people, probably a majority, certainly with reference to the writing, there are a majority of people who would argue that Israel's failure to live up to the terms of the covenant empowered God to give that covenant to the church. And so the church now has inherited the Abrahamic covenant and the covenant of the kingdom and all of those blessings. Our position would certainly be, or my position would certainly be, that there is a future for Israel as a nation in God's eschatological plan, his future plan. And so that those promises have, the failure of Israel has, and I want to be careful here even when I say this, because this is part of the picture, but not all the picture. Certainly Israel's failure to live up to the covenant and to embrace the Messiah is a part of the plan of, is a part of the reason that Israel has been put, so to speak, in suspension. But we will see when we get to Romans chapter 11, not terribly far down the road, that that had always been God's design, and that we could argue theoretically, you know, and talk theoretically about what would happen if Israel had been faithful to the covenant and if they had welcomed the Messiah, but God was never going to permit that to happen, because it had always been God's plan to save Gentiles, and the way that he chose to save Gentiles was by bringing judgment upon Jews. And so we'll get into that, and that's much of what is going on in Romans 9, 10, and 11. All right, back to Isaiah. Isaiah writes about 740 B.C., which places him about 150 years before the destruction of Israel. So Isaiah is talking about things that he will not see in his lifetime. He's about as far away from those events as we are from the American Civil War. So he can talk about them. He can anticipate them. but he does not experience them. That falls to men like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, men who will actually live through that particular time. And he lives by virtue of the dating there, about 740 BC. He is about 20 years to the complete and total destruction of the northern tribes of Israel and its capital city, Samaria. And of course, Israel has existed as a divided nation since Solomon's death, and Isaiah lives in the smaller southern Judah, Jerusalem nation, you know, empire, as opposed to the larger northern Israel, Samaria empire. Politically, both the northern tribes of Samaria and the southern tribes of Judah and its surrounding empires or kingdoms, they are all having a conversation about the same common threat, which is the large and growing power of Assyria. You know, probably for a number of you, and you know, my generation, of course, I can relate to the Gulf War and the ongoing War of Terror, but really the war of my generation was Vietnam. When I entered into high school, the thing was just beginning to wind down, but I entered adolescence like most guys my age, figuring that we were going to get drafted and put into the Army and sent to Vietnam, and that was all that political upheaval. But and you know, we were embroiled in that thing for a way long time. But Vietnam's position, with reference even to communism and its own civil war, had long been, we're not trying to expand communism in the East. We're just trying to come up with a way to protect ourselves against China. And all that is going on in Myanmar today, when you read people, and I would encourage you always to read the letters, and they're very much under the radar these days, but we have a missionary who is a native Burmese man in Myanmar, and they are all very clear that this is being orchestrated by China, our new presidential administration and their softness with reference to China has enabled China to flex its muscles. Japan growing in its concern about China and its growing power. Myanmar growing in concern about China and its expanding power. Taiwan. And all that to say, when Isaiah is alive, his country, Judah and Samaria, which are not really allies any longer, and other nations, they are concerned about the growing power of Assyria. And what are we going to do about Assyria? That's kind of the context there. The nation of Judah is doing very well materially, and it's prospering economically, much like America would be today. The economy is doing, and certainly in our part of the world, the economy is doing very well. Jobs are plentiful, incomes are up, and from that standpoint, things are going very well. But that, of course, is not the view that God looks at. He's not measuring GDP. He is looking at the spiritual condition of a nation. And so when we begin in the book, right, chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, right, God begins by talking about the failure of these covenant people. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. And here, of course, is one of the reasons we know the time frame. In the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So Isaiah lived through these four administrations. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knoweth his owner, and the ass his master's crib, but Israel doth not know, my people doth not consider. So this is a failed covenant nation, and we'll just continue reading. Verse number 4, Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One unto anger. They are gone away backward. Why should ye be stricken any more? Ye will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick, the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot even unto the head, there is no soundness in it but wounds and bruises. and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devoured in your presence. And it is desolate as overthrown by strangers. And the daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. Those are not pretty pictures. Right? That's not what's being conveyed there. Hear the word of the Lord, ye rulers of Sodom, give ear unto the law of our God. Verse number 9. Except the Lord of hosts had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been like unto Gomorrah. So this is the failure of a covenant people. And God goes on to condemn them for their empty religious practices. And so we come down then to verse number 21. How is the faithful city become an harlot? This is not a destroyed city. This is how God views the city of Jerusalem, that it has become like a prostitute to him. It was full of judgment, righteousness lodged in it, but now murderers. And so this is the way that God sees the city. This is the present situation. But in verse number 24, right, God begins to talk about a time when there will be a complete reversal. And that's what's going on in chapter 1, the end of chapter 1 and chapter number 2. We have the present situation that this city that was established, that became the capital city where Solomon's temple was, that was the glorious masterpiece of the empire, is now become like a prostitute and is now filled with criminals. Verse number 24, therefore saith the Lord of hosts, the mighty one of Israel, ah, I will ease me of mine adversaries and avenge me of mine enemies, and I will turn my hand upon thee and purely purge away thy dross and take away all thy sin. And I will restore thy judges as at the first and thy counselors as at the beginning. Afterward thou shalt be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. Zion shall be redeemed with judgment and her converts with righteousness. So there's going to be this restoration. This is the prediction. Let's jump down to chapter 2. The word that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountains of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of God, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. O house of Jacob, come ye, and let us walk in the light of the Lord. Now, at this point, folks, we want to pause and ask ourselves a question. Is this really about Judah and Jerusalem? Verse number 1 says it's about Judah and Jerusalem. But is it literally about Judah and Jerusalem? Or is God addressing the future but as yet unknown church? Because if the church replaces Israel and we are the recipients of the covenant, then these verses are for us. So these are not, I mean, right? I realize that you might be sitting in Sunday school going, you know, there's just 1,000 things going on in my life. And, you know, to have an academic discussion about Israel and the church doesn't really seem to be appropriate. But I'll just throw this at you, right? In the middle, and all of us have 1,000 things going on in our lives. What's our hope? Just what is it that we are waiting for and anticipating? What do we expect to be the conclusion of this? Is this for Judah and Jerusalem, or is it not? That's a question that we have to answer. That's a question you have to answer in your mind. Right? And I would just point out to you that the passage is addressing, and again, here's one of the reasons why this passage is particularly important, because this passage is addressing things that are promised to Abraham in the Abrahamic covenant. And this is, if we have replaced Israel, this is what we are anticipating, that the promises, that all of the promises of the Abrahamic covenant are coming to us. And again, folks, right? Look, I've had conversations with numbers of you, and I am right there in the middle of agonizing and struggling through this. What is the future of the United States of America, my native land, and what is my role in that future? Right? Our president has just publicly announced that not every amendment to the that amendments to the Constitution are not necessarily permanent. I'm just going to go out on a limb here and guess he's not talking about the 13th Amendment. That's the one, if you can't bring it to your mind right off the top of your head, banned slavery. I'm guessing he's talking about the 2nd Amendment. There are numbers of us having conversations about what are we going to do in light of the direction of our country. And a lot of the way that we're going to answer that question is going to hinge on how we interpret passages like Isaiah chapter 2. Right? Jesus said that the violent taketh it by force. Are we the Lord's army? Is our mandate to conquer territory on behalf of Jesus Christ as reformers did and impose upon it Christianity, even if it is against their will, as John Calvin did? Is this where we are? Is this what our expectation is? Are we disobedient for not doing that, or are we disobedient if we do that? In this short passage in Isaiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, the components of the Abrahamic covenant are addressed. In verse number 2, there is the preeminence of Mount Zion. There's the preeminence of Mount Zion, which is not part of the Abrahamic covenant, but it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. In verses 2 through 4, it talks about the pilgrimage of the nations. All of the nations will flow to it. Nations will go to that hill, to that city, to hear the advice of the Lord, and what they will be taught are the ways of the Lord, his ways and his paths and his laws and his words and his judgments and his rebukes. And there will be peace among the nations, right? What did God say to Abraham? In thee shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. So these are all things that are ultimately one way or another tied to the Abrahamic covenant. And I would point out to you folks that Isaiah chapter 2 verses 1 through 5 must clearly be the prediction of a future event. And by future, I don't mean future in Isaiah's day. I mean future in our day. For instance, let me read to you Matthew chapter 10. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughters against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be they of his own household. And by the way, some of you know the experience of that. It is a very grievous thing to be at odds with your own family spiritually. So when Jesus was walking the earth, he said, now this is why I'm here right now. I'm not here to bring peace. I'm a peaceful man. But the very nature of who I am and the very nature of what I demand is going to divide homes. It is going to divide the most intimate of relationships. Well, we don't see any of that in Isaiah chapter 2, folks. We see peace and tranquility and harmony. Go back to Isaiah chapter 2 and verse number 6. Therefore thou hast forsaken thy people, the house of Jacob, because they be replenished, which means filled. They be refilled from the east and are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they please themselves in the children of strangers. Their land also is full of silver and gold, neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land also is full of horses, neither is there any end of their chariots. Right, so I've already mentioned this, right? In Isaiah's day, they're prospering economically. They're prospering militarily. They have a tremendous military. Verse number 8, their land also is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands and that which their own fingers have made. And the mean man boweth down, and the great man humbleth himself. Therefore forgive them not. Enter into the rock and hide thee in the dust for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty. And the point I'm trying to make, folks, is we're reading about something that, again, is not only future in Isaiah's day, it is future in our day. Right? You tell me where you're going to find the fulfillment of this passage. Verse number 10, enter into the rock and hide thee in the dust for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty, and upon everyone that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low. And upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon all the oaks of Bashan, and upon all the high mountains, and upon all the hills that are lifted up, and upon every high tower, and upon every fenced wall, and upon all the ships of Tarshish, and upon all the pleasant pictures. And the loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be made low. And the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day, and the idols he shall utterly abolish. And they shall go into the holes of the rocks, and into the caves of the earth, for fear of the Lord, and for the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake the earth, shake terribly the earth. Where in all the scriptures, folks, do we find anything resembling a fulfillment of that day? Anyone? Turn to the book of Revelation, chapter 6. Let's just start in verse number 15. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath is come. And who shall be able to stand? Right? And what does Isaiah say is going to happen? That people are going to hide in caves during the day of the Lord. In the day of the Lord. So, when is this going to happen? The closest thing that we have, folks, to a biblical fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 2 is Revelation chapter 6. So it appears to me that Isaiah is not just talking about something that is future in his day, it's future in my day. For unless the whole thing is metaphorical or the whole thing is spiritualized, the Lamb has yet to open the seals. As bad as it might be, or as bad as it might become, we are not yet in the day of the Lord. So again, we come back to this question. Is Isaiah predicting something very literal and very real? Or is he talking about something that is metaphorical and spiritualized and idealized? Well, we're going to come back to Isaiah, but let me ask you to turn to the minor prophet of Micah. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Onadiah, Jonah, Micah. And here's what some people argue. Right? Some people say Isaiah is clearly talking about something spiritualized and idealized because it is very much a book of poetry, and it is. Isaiah is very poetical in its nature. And we do know, folks, right? We don't want to back away from this. We understand that poetry tends to be idealized and sometimes very exaggerated language. By the way, even in the scriptures. Right? And I'm looking at the clock thinking I was going to commit 2 weeks to Isaiah, and I'm probably not going to be 3 weeks in Isaiah. But when we want to sit down and have a conversation about music, right? And we want to handcuff music in ways that are biblically unacceptable, right? We must be very, very careful about that. Music must be true. Biblically, music must be true. We cannot sing falsehoods about God. But you find David himself writing inspired psalms using language to describe things that just did not happen physically on earth. I mean, you can read about it, folks. You can read about David running from Saul. And when you read the narrative account, it goes something like this. David was on one side of the mountain. Saul was on the other side of the mountain. And they were doing this little game like you would play with one of your grandkids, you know, as you try to run each other around the table. And then word came that the enemy had come and Saul went away and David made his escape. And then when God has David sit down and write a song about it, you have thunder and lightning and fire and earthquakes. None of those things were there. So we understand that that poetry is allowed a latitude that narrative is not. So is Isaiah just being poetical? And is he just going over the top to describe God's great victory and the beauty and splendor of the kingdom? Or is he being very accurate in what he is describing? Well, Micah gives to us the same kind of information, and Micah's not known for his poetry. Verse number 1 of Micah chapter 4, "But in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the Lord's house, the house of the Lord, shall be established in the top of the mountain, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall come and say, Come and let us go up to the house, to the mountain of the Lord, and to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth in Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore, but they shall sit every man under his vine, and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it. For all people will walk every one in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. In that day, saith the Lord, will I assemble her that halteth, and will gather her that is driven out, and her that I have afflicted. And I will make her that halted a remnant, and her that was cast far off a strong nation. And the Lord shall reign over them in Mount Zion from henceforth, even forever. And thou, O tower of the flock, the stronghold of the daughter of Zion, unto thee it shall come. Even the first dominion, the kingdom, shall come to the daughter of Jerusalem. Now why dost thou cry out aloud? Is there no king in thee? Is thy counselor perished? for pangs have taken thee as a woman in travail. Be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail, for now shalt thou go forth out of the city. Thou shalt dwell in the field, thou shalt go even to Babylon, there shalt thou be delivered. There the Lord shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. Now also many nations are gathered against thee that say, let her be defiled, let her eye look upon Zion. But they know not the thoughts of the Lord, neither understand they his counselor, for he shall gather them as the sheaves under the floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I shall make thine horn iron, will make thy bands brass, make thy hooves brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. Now, here's another question, right? One of the questions we ask of the text is it literal or is it spiritualized? Now when we read Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 12, we're going to pose the same question. We're going to add to that this question. Should this be considered the church? And here's the reason that I'm posing that question. It's because Micah clearly predicts, right, what you have read early in Micah chapter 4, that there's coming a day when the mountain of the Lord's house will be exalted and all the nations will flow to it. And we go, well, that's not really literal. That's just figurative. Then why is the destruction of Babylon literal? Or the destruction of Jerusalem and the carrying away to Babylon? Is that literal? Or is that figurative? On what basis do we argue that the destruction of the nation and deliverance to Babylon is a literal historical fact, but the prediction of the future glory of Israel is just a figurative language? Now look, folks, the Bible does use the nation of Israel in a metaphorical, and if you like to use the word spiritualized, use. We will again deal with this in Romans chapter 9. Just listen to the way Paul speaks in Romans chapter 9. Not as though the word of God hath taken none effect, for they are not all Israel, which are of Israel. Neither because they are the seed of Abraham are they all children. But in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Which sounds like absolute double talk. They're not all Jews that are Jews. They're not all children that are children. So there's clarification. That is, they which are the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God. Right? So there is a sense, folks, in which we do not divide people nationally. The spiritual division is not your ethnicity. The spiritual division is whether you're a child of the spirit or a child of the flesh. But that doesn't undo national identity. It doesn't unravel everything that God has said about national Israel. And there is a spiritualized use of the word Zion, which I'm not going to take the time to look at this morning. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 through 24 is doing one of the things that the preacher in Hebrews does. He is making contrasts between old and new. He is drawing parallels between old and new. He is making contrasts between old and new. In Hebrews 12, he's pointing out to these believing people, people of our generation, by that I mean church age people, that once upon a time the Jews went to physical Sinai. But we're not going to physical Sinai. We're going to heavenly Sinai. We're going to the new place. To the great place. And then he makes the application on that. All right, so here's the question. Why would we reject this spiritualized, idealized account that all God, in other words, folks, there are some people, right? And I kind of talked through this last week, because there are really not two ways to look at this. There are three broad ways that people look at it. And one of the ways that people look at the kingdom is that we're living in it right now. You are living in God's kingdom. And this, and I mean in the fullest sense of the word, this is the kingdom. And then one day you're going to die and you're just going to go to heaven. This is the kingdom. This is the fulfillment of all the predictions that were made in the Old Testament about the kingdom you're living in. Why would we reject that? Right? So I would just argue that we reject it because, number one, the text is very explicit that God is talking about Jerusalem and the nation of Judah. And that no spiritualized use of the words in the New Testament undoes their national implications. Not even, I had read from you to you Romans chapter 9. When you get to Romans chapter 11, you clearly have a nation of Israel. It is my understanding that the nation of Israel existed before the church, alongside the church, and will exist when the church is removed, which is what the rapture really is the removal of the church from the earth. So, furthermore, not only is Isaiah talking about literal Jerusalem and Judah, he is talking about literal nations. This is one of the things that we would argue, or at least that I would argue, folks, is that when that day comes that there is a kingdom and Christ is the king, there will be nations. There may very well be some form of the United States of America and the People's Republic of China and Germany and France and Mexico and Canada. There will be nations. And the Lord will be the king, and He will physically dominate. I made reference to this last week, right? And with, you know, with that evidently requires a little bit of clarification. Most world leaders today, right? Theologically, we would argue they all answer to a sovereign God and they're all under the control of the sovereign God. But they don't recognize that. One of the attributes of the kingdom, folks, is that people are aware of this. And when they go into rebellion, which Zechariah provides for, they know directly whom they're rebelling against. And the consequences of that will be dealt with and addressed at that time in interesting ways. But the big issue is this, folks. If we're really going to buy into and accept that Israel was destroyed as a nation and sent into exile according to the prediction of the Lord, why would we then not accept that God is going to recover that nation when he's arguing that in similar passages, that he's going to destroy them and then he's going to rebuild them, that he has rejected them and then he is going to embrace them? And it just seems to me an unsatisfactory answer to go, well, he is going to fulfill them, but he's rejected Israel. And he's handed that off to the church, and that's the mechanism by which he has satisfied himself. I personally just don't think so. Okay, I'm going to stop there. It's 1:45, and I'll just resume and work through it as far as we need to go next week. All right, it's like 14 minutes to, we'll be back at 11 o'clock. Thank you.